Is okay. Well, that happened behind me. Okay. Anyway, let's show you guys who's here. Okay, John Iadarola, Jimmy Dore, Alonzo Bowden, first
Hello.
Time on the show.
Welcome.
Alonzo, welcome to the Young Turks.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me.
Welcome.
All right. So, if I had to do Alonzo's entire bio, it would take half the show. So let me just say that he won season 3 on NBC's Last Comic Standing. He's on NPR's awesome. Wait, Don't Tell Me, Comedy Congress. Game Show Network's Mind of a Man. Okay, I'm enough. That's
yeah,
enough.
That's enough.
Okay, all right.
That's enough of that.
You get 3 achievements on our show, okay?
Yeah, not any more than that. Okay, so you can stop actually working now, because we're going to read those 3 for the rest of the time. Okay. So Alonzo's going to be with us for both hours. Hell of a show for you guys today, of course. We got racists. In other words, Republicans. We've got, look, that story's amazing. Okay, Gary Johnson, here comes Johnson! And apparently you guys want him to come. So, I'll explain, everybody calm down. I am so excited about the peace deal in Colombia.
Like, really?
I'm ironically on the warpath about that peace deal.
What about that, JR?
Yeah, no, JR, it's super important. No, I know. See, JR does not care about the Colombian people, but we do.
He's just ready to just put a wall at the southern border. Let's not look down there anymore.
Yeah. But anyway, it's not just about Colombia. I think it's about the whole world. That's a super important story. So we'll talk about it a little bit later in the program, obviously. Then the burkini ban in France has gotten so out of hand. I think that they are now trying to emulate the Muslims. Like the Muslim fundamentalists that they think they're fighting, they have become them. Like the new twist in it is amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's all in today's program. All right. Having said all that, let's start with the racist. John, no, I mean the stories. All right. Go ahead, John.
I'm both a racist and a race traitor. Great. Traitor's going to love me. Okay.
Bless you.
Republican Governor Paul LePage of Maine is back in the news just a day after saying that 90% plus of all of the drug dealers arrested in his state are either black or Hispanic and either from the Bronx, Brooklyn, or Waterbury, Connecticut. I've been through Waterbury. It didn't seem that big of a hive of crime and villainy, but apparently it is. People have a problem with that. Not specifically the Waterbury part. Really more of the racial part. And including some politicians in Maine. And in response to that, Paul LePage then left this voicemail on Representative Drew Gattin, a Democrat's message box.
Mr. Gattin, this is Governor Paul Richard LePage. I would like to talk to you about your comments about my being a racist, you cocksucker. And I want to talk to you. I want you to prove that I'm a racist. I've spent my life helping black people, and you little son of a bitch, socialist cocksucker, I need you to, I want you to record this and make it public because I'm after you. Thank you.
I said, that was polite at the end. I think I went too far. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to do a partial defense of him before we rip him apart. So we've discussed he said it. We're discussing. We're going to be adults, and we're going to say the word. Okay. We've discussed the word cocksucker before, right? Mm-hmm. Jimmy, I know you think it's a bit of a high compliment.
Sure. That's like the nicest thing you could do for somebody. You know, that's nicer than helping someone move. That should be like the nice. That should be a term of endearment. This is my wife and cocksucker, Mary. She's the best. I love her.
I think that is not necessarily
the way he was using it. No, I don't think that was the way.
I don't think he was using it as a compliment. That's fair, John. Right? Mm-hmm. And he was using it towards a male, which then, of course, puts a different tinge on it. Right. By the way, it's a terrible insult. Yeah. Don't use it towards females either.
Okay? Yeah. If I had a guess, I would say it's probably 80% of the time used towards males.
Uh-huh.
Because they want to get in the homophobic angle. And we'll get into that in his defense. But I think that's the intent. Is it's not, oh, you're disgusting. It's, oh, you're below me. You're a deviant. I think that's been the goal
you
the
think
whole time.
So? I think it's just, that is a, it's a word that people have used forever, especially a guy LePage's age. And maybe partly they used it forever because there was homophobia forever, right? Mm-hmm. So that certainly could be a big part of it. To me, the racist stuff is much more important than him being so vituperative against this particular guy. And the other part that I'll defend is, I like that he's like, I want you to record this because I'm coming for you. It sounds like the kind of thing, honestly, I might say.
Come and see.
Okay, let's get to his defense, and then I want to hear what you guys think about the whole scenario.
Okay, so when asked about this, he said, I called Gatine and used the worst word I could think of, which is, again, telling if he thinks that that is the worst possible thing you could be. I apologize for that to the people of Maine, but I make no apology for trying to end the drug epidemic that is ravaging our state. Legislators like Gatine would rather be politically correct and protect ruthless drug dealers than work with me to stop this crisis that is killing 5 Mainers a week. So this is a message that we've seen from Donald Trump, too. The idea that when they say something horrendous and offensive, there isn't time to not say something disgusting and repulsive. It's like, come on, we got so much to do. I can't not call you a racial slur or something like that. I don't think that it's one or the other. You either help out the people of your state or you call people cocksuckers.
Well, so, and the ironic part of that, and the thing that I'm, again, more angry at him for, is that he actually had time to issue veto threats for bills that actually would have helped people afflicted with drugs. That would have not only increased, by the way, penalties against drug dealers, etc., but it would have also helped clinics. And he's like, well, if you're going to do drug clinics that actually help the people who are addicted, no, I'm threatening to veto that. I can't have that because I'm too busy calling people cocksuckers, right? So, no, if you were actually addressing the problem, well, that's a whole different scenario. But you're actually blocking some of the solutions to the problem while just yelling at people and doing it for what appears to be political advantage. Like, oh, I'm going to be tough and you're going to see. I'm not going to actually do anything because I'm a Republican. I don't believe in the government. All I believe in is punishing crime and criminals. I'll turn everything into criminal and punish them, right? Especially if they're minorities. And I don't say that lightly. In this case, that's what Paul LePage is about.
Yeah, so this is something that we covered months and months ago on the show. It's the first thing that he became famous for on the Young Turks Network. So here are comments that he originally made about black drug dealers earlier this year.
People that take drugs, these are guys of the name D-Money, Smoothie, Shifty, these type of guys that come from Connecticut, New York. They come up here, they sell their heroin, then they go back home. Incidentally, half the time they impregnate a young white girl before they leave, which is a real sad thing, because then we have another issue that we got to deal with down the road.
Yeah, right. He did have another issue that he had to deal with because of the comments that he made. And so, just in case you don't think that this is proof of the racism, he eventually apologized, which is in this clip.
No way.
It wasn't intended to be race. It was intended to be Maine. Maine, I am very passionate about Maine. It was all about Maine. And I apologize again. My brain was slower than my mouth.
That's the most honest thing ever.
Okay, well, that last part is, I guess, true. All right, so to me, that's indicative. It's not like, so when he says, hey, come in here and impregnate the white girls, we're pretty much done here, right? So you get a sense of what Paul LePage is about. Now, it doesn't, like, he says with such fury that he is not a racist. That's what that whole cocksucker voice message was about. How dare you call me racist? Now, hold, like, he does have an interesting point. He has raised a Jamaican kid for a long time, since I think he was 12, okay? So, and he says he's his son. I don't know if he technically adopted him, but that's okay. He raised him for a long, long time. So, that's a super interesting caveat to Paul LePage. But that doesn't mean, but hold on now. That doesn't mean that you don't have preconceived notions about race. Like, so you've done a wonderful thing in raising a kid, bless your heart, right? But that doesn't mean it wiped away everything that was in your head. Because in that moment where your mouth was working faster than your brain, you thought, damn it, these drug dealers are impregnating the white girls. You thought that, you said that, and that's in your head. So we can have a debate about whether he's a racist, although I'm not sure it's much of a debate, right? But that notion that's in his head is racist.
Yeah.
Right? That's the definition of racism,
right? White guys don't sell drugs, and they also don't impregnate white women.
Okay. We have been busy. We've been busy with both. You know, the first thing is, I've yet to hear someone say, I am not a racist, who isn't. You know what I mean? Like, that's the first clue. As soon as I hear, I am not a racist, like, yes, you are. But you look at this, guy, like the cocksucker thing, and it is, like you said, it's an old school white guy insult. But yeah, it's the homophobic part. Like, that's what they think. This is the worst thing you could be
yes.
as a male, is to be a cocksucker. And then the whole thing with D-Money and Shifty and, you know, impregnating white girls. Like, first of all, I didn't know it was that easy, or I'd have been going to Maine earlier. Like, I didn't know you
it's
just had to
drive.
Show up and, yo, man, D-Money in the house and just knock one off. I didn't know. But it all goes back to the old school stereotypical image of a drug dealer. Right now, the drug problem in places like Maine, it's a heroin problem, it's a pill problem. This is a white problem, and a lot of it is a white middle class problem. And he's sitting up there looking for black drug dealers. If you're a black drug dealer, if you say you are that stereotypical corner drug dealer from the Bronx, do you know how quick you'd be arrested in Maine? Like, the minute you rolled up in Maine in your Cadillac with your wheels on it and stepped out in your hoodie, they'd be like, excuse me, D-Money? Yeah, we need to talk to you. You know, they're getting their drugs from their doctors. And then once their doctors stop prescribing Oxy, they're getting heroin from street dealers or from dealers who, you know, go to the PTA meeting. You know what I mean? Yeah. So hit. And like you said, the problem with drugs, if you really want to fight the problem, is in treatment. Mm-hmm. In treatment and recovery. And they don't want to put any money into this. He wants to arrest every black person he sees in Maine. Yeah.
So that's such an important point, because in another racially charged statement, Paul LePage said 90% of the people who are drug dealers in Maine are black or Latino. And when challenged on it, he said, I have their pictures on my desk, you know, the people, the drug dealers who've been arrested in Maine. That's because, as Alonzo points out, the minute a black guy walks into Maine with whatever stereotypical car he has, et cetera, right. They're on him, like, immediately. But there might be plenty of white drug dealers in Maine who they don't notice because they mix in with the other Mainers who are 95% white, according to Paul LePage.
And he's focusing on drug dealing of illegal drugs. He doesn't care as much about the drugs that are given by people who are able to write on pads and legally prescribe them, even though those are the ones that lead to far more deaths. So, as Lonzo pointed out, a lot of them are doctors, and also reps for pharmaceutical companies. They're the ones putting all the incentives on doctors to prescribe drugs that are far more powerful and addictive than they need to be. We covered studies recently showing that in some cases marijuana can be used to treat the same pain symptoms, but without the needless addiction and rates of suicide and death and all that, overdose.
Can I just say, because you guys are making the most important point there. So in the midst of all the insults and the, you know, and all this stuff, don't lose track of why we have the problem that we have. It's not because a couple of out-of-state drug dealers came in to meet the demand in Maine for drugs, and it doesn't matter what their race is. The problem is the demand. And yes, the people who are demanding the drugs happen to be white in Maine, but that's of course not the issue either. The question is, how did that demand arise?
Yeah.
And as we've covered on the show, and as Alonzo and John just pointed out, they start as painkillers, OxyContin. This is happening all across the country.
Yeah.
And it's happening to white people, it's happening to black people, it's happening to everybody. And actually, when it was happening, when the drugs were more of an issue that people thought afflicted African Americans in the cities, et cetera, well, there's a little less of a priority. Now all of a sudden this heroin thing is an epidemic because it's affecting white people across the country. They're like, wait a minute, we gotta do something about this. Okay, we gotta do something, right? And so if you want to do something, if Paul LePage was genuine and you didn't care and you thought he was a real guy for insulting people and thinking like you do and you got past all of that stuff, well, the problem is he isn't doing anything about the thing that's causing the demand, because then he would have to challenge Republican donors,
yeah,
like the drug companies. And by the way, they're Democratic donors too. Okay,
yeah.
Those drug companies are the number one donors in the country, more than the oil companies, more than the banks. Because they got to push.
Clinton,
I mean, you want to talk about drug dealers? They are literally drug dealers, but they do it on a mass scale to the tune of billions of dollars. It's not to say that no one should ever receive a prescription for OxyContin, but we should be super careful about that, because it is what is driving this heroin epidemic. So, but instead of doing something about that real problem, Paul LePage says, I got it. Let's blame black people. Call it D-Money and Shifty and all this other stuff. And say, oh, my God, on top of that, they screwed our white women. Yeah. So, now, do you think he's really addressing the real problem?
So, 2 points. So, the people in Maine have the demand for the heroin, but they can't get it themselves because they're white. Right? So, how are they supposed to get it? A, maybe they should import some black people to live there. My other point was that is this because of the OxyContin that's like a new drug from the last 15? When did that get invented? Because Vicodins, I don't understand how it's, why is all of a sudden we're having this?
It's because it's more powerful.
Yeah,
because
OxyContin,
the thing about taking drugs is you get hooked on one drug and then you need something more powerful. So if you're in the Vicodin world, then Oxy is more powerful, and heroin is cheaper. It's cheaper to buy heroin on the street than to get your OxyContin pills. Now, the thing about Governor LePage, though, see, I disagree with you. I don't think the problem here has anything to do with drugs. Mm-hmm. All right, this is straight out racist. This guy, like, he wants no black people in Maine. That's his thing.
I think he just achieved it too.
The five of them left. You know, they went to Vermont. But watch the
drug use go up in Vermont.
His whole thing, his anger is not pointed toward the drugs. It's pointed toward black people, you know, the whole D-Money, Shifty, impregnate white women. Because historically, and I mean this goes back to the beginnings of slavery, the biggest fear of white men is black men attacking their women.
Well,
right?
We know that, how you that work. Is what, First that you take is our what, jobs, you know, lynching, and then you take our women. I know how
and,
it works.
And everything else. It all goes back to when it was illegal for a black man to even look at a white woman. Yeah. So when you talk about the Republican Party and the way they prey on fear, because they love that this is the greatest fear to have, that this black guy, besides coming up here, is now impregnating your daughter. You know, it'd be different if they had like a basketball powerhouse school and he was coming up to play ball. Then you're allowed to have white women, by the way, Jimmy. So it is accepted. Jimmy's nervous. I want you to know it is accepted on a sports basis. Yeah. But this guy, it has nothing to do with drugs. I don't think drugs are the issue here. I don't think protecting Maine is the issue, other than his thing of, well, I want to protect Maine. I'm telling white people that I want to protect Maine from black people and Latino people. That's his code.
We talk about projection a lot on this show. The origins of that fear that you need to protect the scarcest resource in your race is your women, and that you need to protect them is probably just protection based on several hundred years of systematic rape of female slaves.
So
across the country for a couple of hundred years, then you fear, oh shit, if they're free now, they're going to do the same thing back to us.
Right. So, look, this is the point where the conservatives' heads will explode, but there's a lot of projection that goes on there. And sometimes some of the conservative talk shows have literally said this, like, oh, what if they do, you know, they haven't said what if they do to us what we've been doing to them, because that would be far too honest. But that's exactly what they've intimated. So in their mind, hey, we're used to getting favors, right? We own this world. So I get to give my son the job that I had, and I don't want him competing with blacks or Latinos or anyone else. I just give him that job, right? And I have my spot in the country club, and I have it. That's mine. I don't want to share it with anybody else. I'm used to getting all the favors. So if minorities get in charge, they will want the same favors that I've been used to getting my whole life. Yeah. Now, again, this is a pretty old school. If you're a young white guy in the middle of Nebraska, you ain't getting no favors. I know that. Okay,
is this how you bring up Luke Russert again? Is that what this is?
Okay, all right, listen. And then to John's point, and this is, you know, it's controversial, but it's true. So, and again, it isn't about a young white guy in the middle of the country today. I know you didn't do it. We all know you didn't do it, okay? But about culture and how it affects people like Paul LePage, who's a little bit older and is used to being in charge, right? For centuries in this country, in the South, the white masters got to rape their slaves. And so that is so uncomfortable that we don't talk about it in our history classes nearly to the level that we should. You know human nature. I mean, they mention it in passing. You think it happened in passing? When one person has absolute power over another person, owns that person, what do you think guys do? Now, you don't have to, it's not a matter of conjecture. We know what happened, right? So then the thought is, well, if we did that, well, I guess they would do it too, given the opportunity. So we have to make sure that we do not give them the opportunity, okay? So that's how it started. That's how it started. And then that becomes a part of the culture that gets passed down, unfortunately. Now, the good news is I think it's getting passed down less and less and less every generation. But there are vestiges of that are left, and you see it in someone like LePage's comments.
Yeah. Well, why don't we see, well, I have another instance of one of those vestiges in social media, if you want to turn to that.
Just really quick about the drug thing, too. It all starts with the criminalization of addiction, right? So we're still doing that. Our friend Josh Mankiewicz did a great report. I forget the northeastern state, but it was about a police chief there decided to stop arresting people for drugs instead of start. They're not doing that anymore, and they're getting them treatment. And they're talking about, it was a whole thing about all the success they're having with it, and these people who were would be in jail now come back to thank him for saving their lives because they got clean. So yeah. I just think that's a bigger thing. We need to stop criminalizing addiction. For some reason, we all want to say, okay, now marijuana's okay. We don't want to put you in jail for that. But if you do heroin, we want to put you in jail. I just saw Debbie Wasserman Shields say that in her debate with Tim Canova. Oh, yeah. It's just like, why is one addiction, why is alcoholism okay, but heroin addiction, you're a bad person? I don't. That doesn't make sense.
Well, it's another debate, but it's the business of prisons. Mm-hmm. Prisons are big business, you know, private prisons, prison labor being used to build and make things. And Cenk, you mentioned the Midwest, the white guy in the Midwest. They have a completely different drug problem. They have a meth problem.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting because I forget what state it was, but they examined a white community with meth, and it was the same breakdown as a black community with crack in the 80s, where it started out on the street. Then it expanded. Suddenly people were losing their jobs because they were just meth heads, you know, and the crime went up. And in other words, it's their drug. That's like the white rural drug. I mean, it's everywhere, but it's the same thing. But yeah, the business isn't treatment. The money's isn't in treatment. The money's in prison. Yeah. You know, the money's in locking them away and building these prison industrial complexes.
But you know what? I think we're going to win on that issue. In fact, we're in the middle of winning. And so let me explain why. This is also very, very important. Look, in the past, the idea was you criminalize this because we've got it backwards. It wasn't they were so concerned about the drug problem, hence they decided to criminalize it. It was they decided to criminalize some minorities and then figured out, oh, we can do it through drugs. And that's, again, you could just watch documentaries on it, read up on the history of it. We originally started calling pot marijuana Mexican immigrants because we were trying to figure out a way to get them. And
they call it hemp or cannabis, and they used to be grown all the time.
Right.
That's right.
And so the opium we made illegal, it used to be legal, we made it illegal to get the Chinese immigrants.
That's right.
And so, and then crack, we made much worse penalties for it to get imprisoned more blacks, immigrants in a sense, right? And so now, the reason I think we're going to win and get rid of some of those private prisons and decriminalize this is because finally it's affecting white people on a scale where white legislators then turn around and go, oh, no, wait a minute, I don't want to put my people in jail. Well, no, we're not going to do that anymore. So that's why some of the people who are leading the charge are now Republicans. Not LePage, he's from the old days, like Rand Paul in Kentucky. In Kentucky, they got a giant drug problem, and it's mainly white people. So all of a sudden, one of the most conservative guys in the Senate is like, maybe we shouldn't put people in prison for drugs anymore. Oh, I wonder why. Now, look, I give him all the credit in the world anyway because he's headed in the right direction. I don't care why he does it, etc. Let's just decriminalize because it's so stupid, and I'll take any allies I can get. So don't get me wrong on that. But understand the underlying things that are happening on this issue.
Yeah.
And that's why, and I'll predict it for you right now, and you'll see it. We will begin to decriminalize drugs on a mass scale because it is affecting white people on a mass scale. And so, and by the way, just one last thing. It's not like white folks don't get in a room and make decisions like 10 people at Davos or wherever.
It's a couple times bigger than that.
Yeah.
I'll let you know the next time we
meet. Right. There's no cabal and stuff. It's a lot of people's subconscious, reactions to social phenomenon, etc. And it's natural reactions like, but wait a minute, I see that affected my cousin. And I know my cousin's not a bad guy. I know he's not a criminal.
It becomes real to them.
That's right.
Yeah.
And when it becomes real to them and they go, well, well, Bob shouldn't be sitting in jail. That's so stupid. He's got an addiction problem like Joe does. He says Joe's with alcohol and Bob's with, you know, because he got started on OxyContin because of his back pain. What the hell are we putting that guy in jail for? Yeah. Right? And so then they go, oh, I see. Especially with the Republicans, they never know something is a problem until it happens to them.
They need right. direct. Right. And the evidence has to be direct and close, familial, and pounded into their face.
Right. And then finally,
even then, 30% resistant.
So that's why, so the unfortunate part that the drug problem has grown so large that it's affecting almost, you know, every community in the country.
Yeah.
The fortunate part of that is that at least it'll lead to decriminalization.
Exactly. I
promise we're moving on. But that's the reason why I'm not giving Rand Paul any credit, because they find the next thing to criminalize. It keeps progressing. It was illegal, as you pointed out, to look at white women. They find the next thing that they're better than the minorities for anyway. They'll find something else criminalized. We need to find a way to make sure that they equalize their view of people. Like the vision that someone is lower than you, they'll find a way to continue to keep them lower than you. So because they're decriminalized or may decriminalize now, because now white folks are affected, they'll find the next thing to say, oh, but you're not as good as us on this thing. They need to keep the system. So we change that and you're okay.
No, I hear you, Jared, but their other problem in that regard is that they're starting to become the minority. So they could keep doing that in Maine, and maybe that's why LePage has gotten elected a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But you can't do that in California, where whites are the minority. You can't do that in many places in the country. And that is part of what is leading to this explosion of the angry white man that we're seeing in the form of Trump and his supporters.
Yeah.
Like, they see that power slipping away from them. They're like, no, come back.
Well, another thing you said is true. That young white guy or white woman has black friends now. And
that's
they have
right.
Latino friends. So you can't tell them the same lies that you used to.
Yeah.
Because now they're like, well, no, I go to school with a guy, and he's not what you said, or I know this woman, and she's not. So now everything their parents told them more and more is being proven to be a lie. So, you know, hopefully we're on the right way. But what you said is exactly right. They will try to find another way to make it different. And the thing with the black male, and this has gone on throughout history, it's the hyper everything about the black male, right? So the cop had to shoot the black male because he has superhuman strength. He's stronger than anybody. And the black male has to be stopped because his sexuality is so much more powerful. That's why you have to protect the white woman and all that. I mean, this has been historically, that's what they've put on us, that black males are somehow, you know, and so the weirdest thing, right, because it's like they're lesser than us, but they're superior in strength, superior in sexuality, superior in athletic ability, but they're lesser than,
well,
you know,
it's
the craziest argument.
They always try to tie it to animalistic characteristics.
Right, right.
I mean, I'm not as fast as a tiger, but I consider myself better than a tiger.
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing. Actually, during, I believe it was around the time of Michael Brown, we covered a lot of historical newspaper posts about the attacks of black men, and they describe them as gigantic, simian, all that stuff.
How about we make decriminalize drugs, but we criminalize wearing your pants too low? How about that? Is that okay?
Well, Bill Cosby would have agreed.
That's true. And a lot of
I say that if you are a black cocksucker named Shifty or D-Money, you should stay out of Maine.
We can go either direction.
Yeah. Okay, let's. Before we take our first break, why don't we do this other story, because it's somewhat related. This video is intended to serve as a reminder to politicians that when you post things on social media, we can actually read them. We see what you say, and it's easy to forget that, especially in the wake of a loss. If you've just lost an election like Mayor Patsy Skipper of Midland City, Alabama did, you might find yourself posting something like this. So Belinda, a nice friend of Patsy, says, "Patsy, this is Don. How is the election going?" And Patsy responds,
"Oh, no!"
Okay, you got to read it because some people watch the audio.
So Patsy Capshaw Skipper says, "I lost, the N-word won," except did not write the N-word.
And she's the word.
And Belinda Thompson responds, "I'm so sorry." And I like to assume that in her mind she's saying that you just wrote that.
Right.
So it was just very casual. It wasn't a message, by the way. It was a posting on Facebook that's there. We're flying into other galaxies, that will still be on Facebook. I'm so sorry that happened to you.
Like, can you imagine? Not only did you lose, but, you know. Okay, and by the way, so the excuse that racists will often use is, no, I heard it in a rap song. Okay. Okay. I don't get the sense that this woman heard it in a rap song.
It's possible.
And she did not put an A at the end. She wrote out ER, okay. Yeah. And so, but the amazing thing is, I bet if you ask Patsy today, what's the first thing she'd say?
I'm not racist.
Oh.
Nobody is.
Nobody thinks
that they are a racist.
Yeah, because I bet you she genuinely believes it. And she would probably tell you, what are you talking about? There's a, you know, a Betsy down the street who I know and who I'm a decent human being to, right? Yeah. And I even held the door for her once. And like, no, what are you, like.
You guys are making a big deal. I watch that Def Comedy Jam, and they use that word all the time, and no one cares. Yeah. Why, all of a sudden, I say it, and it's a big deal.
There's no time to lose an election and not use the N-word online.
That's like, right.
There's no time.
There's no time. It takes time to be politically. That's what Dr. Laura said, by the way. When she used the N-word, she said it to a caller a couple times, and she said, well, why is it when I watch the Def Comedy Jam, and they use the N-word all the time, and I was always wondering, who is watching Def Comedy Jam? And now I know it's Dr. Laura.
It's a roundabout way to insult Def Comedy Jam.
I mean, the extreme case, by the way, of what I'm talking about is, we did a story once on the Young Turks where a guy said some horribly racist stuff, and then when I pressed on it, he said, no. Of course I'm not racist. I've had black people in my house. I've even let them use the bathroom.
Oh!
There you go. I mean, this
You
is,
let them use the bathroom?
This goes back to the what I said before. Whenever you hear, I am not a racist. Now, keep in mind, racism had gone away until Barack Obama brought it back.
That's right.
Okay? Just remember, there was no racism, and Barack Obama brought it back in 2009. You know, in Alabama, this is the thing that's funny about this. Maybe only to black people, I don't know. But when an old white lady in Alabama says the nigger won, like, we're not surprised. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, not, oh my gosh, they're racist. Well, yeah, it's an old white lady in Alabama. Yeah, she's a racist. That's what they are. You know, and they act like we're just bringing this up. The interesting thing about Facebook, video, et cetera, the whole social media campaign, it's basically saying to black people, like, hey, you know, you guys were right for the past 400 years. Like, apparently you weren't lying. You know? Apparently, when you said old Alabama people are racist, apparently you were onto something. So now it comes out that, and to her, that is an ordinary thing to say to nigger one. And then what she'll say is about her friend, well, you know, Betsy down the block. No, she's one of the good ones.
Yeah.
She knows how to act.
Yeah,
part of
that 10% you don't
hear
about.
She's one of the good ones, so she's all right. She ain't like that nigger Shifty or D-Money who impregnated my daughter. You know, and to these people, and you talked about the Trump supporters and all, to them, this is normal. This isn't, they don't think of it as racism because they think in the natural order of things, I am better than a nigger. So they don't think of that as an insult. They think that's like you were saying, like as a human, I'm better than a tiger or whatever animal. To them, this is the natural order of the universe. This is what you're up against. And as a black person, you know this. You know when you go to the South, you know, I joke about it, but when you're in a town, you better know what year it is. You better know if you're in a town that's 2015 or if you're in a town where it's still 1857. She's from a town where it's right around 1920. You know, right, there's a few niggers who can read. You know, that's her problem. One of them niggers could read, and they beat me as governor. You know, I mean, as mayor or whatever. But it's horrible. But it is a reality.
Yeah. So just give you the quick facts on what actually happened. So the person who posted that comment was actually interim mayor, was functioning as the leader of that community.
Wow.
Mayor Skipper was named interim mayor last February when her husband, former mayor Virgil Skipper, retired for health reasons. County officials voted 3-1 for her to take over the position. But unfortunately, the community did not vote in that way. So she ended up getting 148 votes. But Joanne Bennett Grimsley got 233, and Skipper was defeated by Joanne Bennett, who had been the former assistant city clerk and an employee of the Dale County government for 27 years, previously serving as the city's water clerk and county court clerk, who seems like, based on that description, to be a public servant for literally decades.
No, that's another one of those amazing things. You know, So no matter what Joanne Bennett Grimsley did, for served the government ably for 27 years, have all those different positions, county clerk, all this stuff, doesn't matter, still the N-word.
And
so if you can't see how people might be frustrated about that, I don't think you're trying hard enough, because you don't want to see it. And you're so right, Alonzo, about people's perspective. One of the things that people like to call me, my critics like to call me online, is brown. Like, they think that's a big insult.
Yeah.
And I can't, for a long time, I didn't understand why they kept going to that. I mean, they're trying to get under my skin, but you're saying something fairly factual. I'm like,
right.
And I kept thinking, like, waiting for the other shoe to drop, like, and, right? But for them, from their perspective, that's the heaviest insult they can give someone. So they think, like, I got him, I called him brown. Well, I can't believe that's not bothering him. I mean, if I was brown, boy, it would bother me, right? Because they're thinking at it from their perspective, and they can't see otherwise.
Yeah. Almost, well, as bad as being a woman.
The best, the best insult you can hit Patsy with is, you know, you lost to a nigger. Just keep in mind, you lost to a nigger, so good luck with life.
Okay, let me.
She had a, she denied that it was her.
Uh-huh. And as, I know, her, as she got hacked, I know.
She hacked,
my Facebook has been messed up for several weeks, and I haven't been using it. I think I've been hacked.
Oh, hackers are racist.
No, she got hacked by another Alabama racist that happened to be living right next to her.
And how about her friend didn't go, whoa, your penis goes, sorry.
I haven't heard this from you before. Is this someone hacking you right now?
Benign thing you've ever said to me.
Because you know what people are thinking, man? I got to hack the runner-up in the Midland City Alabama mayoral race.
Gotta stay on top of that.
There were
250 votes. Yeah, total.
Yes.
Okay, we got to take a break, man. All right, we got a lot more stories for you guys if we can get to them, including what the American people think of Gary Johnson. We'll be right back. All right, back on the Young Turks. So I've got too many tweets here, and a lot of them are complimentary of Alonzo, so we'll just skip all those.
thank you.
Joyful Noise, I'll give you one. Alonzo Bowden is a great addition to the power panel. He's got an awesome voice, so that's good, too. And yay, hashtag Mordor. Nice compliment of you as well, Jim. Oh, Jimmy, John and I, we're chopped liver, right? Okay, but whatever. So
I'll be back next week anyway, so whatever.
Okay. By the way, Monday morning, especially for you members, because you get to live stream it, I'm going to be talking to America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio. Papit. Okay, Ring of Fire. Man, it's appropriately called Ring of Fire. If you've ever seen the show, he breathes fire. Okay, he's not playing. Like, he makes me look shy. So I'm going to be talking to him at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time on Monday. So if you're already a member, tytnetwork.com/join is how you become a member. If you are, just watch it live. Okay, just want to let you guys know that. And, oh, yeah, I'm up next because I got Loser Donald. All right, roll Loser Donald. Bloop, 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 bloop. We've got a quick Loser Donald segment for you guys today. It will go back to 2006, because in this segment we might be doing things that are in the news today, or showing you 100 different instances of, literally in our case, we started 100 days before the election. Every day we do one, including the weekends, of how Donald Trump has been a loser in almost everything he's ever attempted. So it's super ironic when he goes, oh, we're going to be winning with me. We're not winning anymore. He keeps saying we're not winning anymore because in his life, he's not winning anymore. Okay, so I've told you about a bunch of his bankruptcies, Trump steaks, Trump airplanes, Trump casinos. So this is about Trump Mortgage. In 2006, he starts up Trump Mortgage. He says it's going to be fantastic. It's going to be the best mortgage company. Turns out, no, not true. Not the best mortgage company. Bankrupt. Of course! When has he not gone bankrupt? So it was, but look, to be fair, it had a long run of 18 months. Before it collapsed. And then when it collapsed, they said, well, what the hell, man? You screwed up and he had another company. And he's like, Trump Mortgage, what name so? He's like, I never heard of that. Like, no, I wasn't involved in that. Dude, it's called Trump Mortgage. You're unbelievable. So then right afterwards, he starts Trump Financial, Okay, anybody want to guess if Trump Financial is still in business or if that's also bankrupt?
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, good reason, John. It's also bankrupt. Yeah. Okay. Guys, seriously, if you support Trump, you have no idea what you're supporting. It's a spoiled brat. Great quote from Ann Richards about George W. Bush back in the day applies to Trump in spades. He was born on third base and thought he hit a triple.
Yeah.
Okay, but Trump was born like an inch from home plate, fell backwards, got tagged out, and still thought he hit a homer. Right. I've in covering Trump in all this time, I have not seen one successful thing he's done. We used to say The Apprentice, and then the guy who ran Apprentice at NBC came out the other day and said, oh no, it was the lowest rated show. Like, it barely survived. The guy's a loser through and through, so just understand what you're buying.
Super fast. That was like around 2006, 2007, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I love that. He talks about like his business instincts. Just as the industry is about to go over the cliff, he's like, I got to get in now. Great instincts, loser Donald.
No, you're absolutely right, John. In fact, people warned him about that because it's not just a couple of guys from, you know, The Big Short that thought, hey, wait, this mortgage market and this housing market's in a little bit of trouble here starting around 2006, 2007. I mean, he couldn't have started at a worse time. No. And you know what he was like? Oh, don't be ridiculous. It's white hot. I got this. Because that's how he is. He's like, oh, I'll fix it. I'm on it. I'm Trump. Trump Mortgage. Trump Financial. Bam. In the bottom of a ditch as always. The guy's a monumental loser.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Forward. What's next?
Okay. Let's talk about third-party candidates. Although Governor Gary Johnson hasn't yet risen high enough in the presidential polls to qualify for the presidential debates just yet, the American people have been asked and they've spoken. They want to see him on the stage. There's a new poll from Quinnipiac University that shows 62% of likely voters nationally say that Johnson should be included in the debates this year, breaking down to 60% of Democrats and 56% of Republicans, which really fast is pretty interesting since he is much more on the right side of the political spectrum, but there are actually more Democrats who want to see him debating, which perhaps says more about Hillary Clinton than it does about Gary Johnson, and a little bit higher than that in terms of the independents, obviously, since that's his base of support. Now, they did not ask about Jill Stein there. I imagine the reason is that while Gary Johnson is close to passing the threshold, he's at about 9 or 10% in most polls, and you need to pass 15 in a couple of the most, the biggest polls to qualify. Jill Stein is still at about 3 or 4% in most polls. But I do have some other information about third-party candidates that I think that I looked into the raw data and thought was pretty interesting. But first of all, he's at 9 or 10% yet. They keep talking, and we've talked about this on the show, they keep saying you have to pass 15% to get in. But why isn't that, if you're going to have like four debates, why not have more people in the first one? And then maybe raise the standards. Why not have an undercard debate?
Well, I'll tell you why, John.
Why?
Because people with fucking money don't want that to happen.
That's probably why.
That's why.
That's probably why.
What don't you get?
I was teeing you up.
It used to be that the League of Women Voters ran the debates, right? Mm-hmm. So it was an independent body. And they were really interested in making sure everything was on the up and up. And the two parties were like, hey, everything's on the up and up. This is bad for us.
Yeah.
So they took it away from the League of Women Voters. They created their own thing. And now everything's corrupt.
Yeah. So, but you have to understand that the debate commission is run by the Democratic and Republican parties.
Yes.
They appoint the heads of them.
Yes.
Who are major Democratic, former Democratic officials and former Republican officials. So the fix is in from the beginning.
I defy you to identify one case in which the RNC or the DNC has put pressure on the electoral system in any way.
And he's
got nothing.
So, and the guy who goes around saying the whole thing is rigged, Donald Trump, well, this is literally rigged.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, he's not complaining about it.
It doesn't matter so much. Gary Johnson, no.
But it's also TV, right? It's the business of TV. These are the two candidates that get the ratings. You know what I mean? Like the thing about all the rules of elections and people want to change and all that, and I get that, you can't change it now. You have to change it in between the election. It's like football. Like the NFL Rules Committee meets after the season. You can't meet during the playoffs and say, hey, we need to change some rules because this isn't right. You know what I mean? So I get it. And, if the 15% standard is wrong or if whatever, you know, that we need to change in this, you'll never get it changed going into the debates.
Yeah.
So you got to change it in between when you say, okay, listen, for the next president, like we learned this, We looked at this. Now, are you going to be able to change it with the way money, like John said, with money and television and the RNC and the DNC? I doubt it. I don't know how you're going to change this. I don't know how you're going to convince them, hey, the ratings would be better if we had more candidates that some people don't know the views of or can't easily identify.
Yeah. So let me disagree, because perfectly fair points, but I think in the context of politics, it's a little bit different. Your only chance to fix it is when people are paying attention. Mm-hmm. Because if during the off season in politics, nobody pays enough attention to get in there and tell the establishment, have enough heat on the establishment for the establishment to do something that is against their own interest.
Yeah.
They will never do that in the off season. So the only time to do it is strike while the iron is hot. Go to the establishment and say, wait a minute, this isn't fair that you're rigging the rules. And you're obviously rigging the rules. It's the most obvious thing in the world. You guys run the debate and you won't let anybody in unless they get this ridiculously high number from the start without even being introduced to the American people in any way, shape, or form, right? So the way that this happens practically, the other part you're saying about practically it's not going to happen, 99 times out of 100 or maybe 9 out of 10, whatever, normally you'd be totally right, right? In this case, I think we've got a little different situation because of Trump. Trump's such a wild card that there are plenty of people within the Republican Party who think,
Gary Johnson, maybe.
It is true, because you can't take him seriously as a candidate. The old school Republicans are like, give us somebody else. I understand what you're saying. I just don't think that they're going to change the rules now. And even when it comes to changing the rules in between, that is when the Republicans are very good at changing the voting rules, right? That's when they do it. In the midterm elections is when they come up with these weird, you know, whether they be residential rules or whatever they do to rig who can vote.
You got
to
go show.
That's when they do it.
You got to show your license again on a plane, Alonzo. That's all I'm saying. The point is, what we need to do is have ranked voting, right? This is a little bit off topic of the debates, but you know, it's this whole third party thing, and should we give them attention? And people are wagging their finger at me saying you can't vote for a third party because Trump, right? And you're like, well, what if I agree with their ideas? You know, and then they're like, well, you can't vote for them until a lot of people are already voting for them. Yeah. Well, how do you get there?
Well, it's that you know what the result will be.
The only way you get to a lot of people voting for a third party. Hey, by the way, Abraham Lincoln, third party candidate. We'll be right back.
So what I hope will happen in terms of the debate is they won't be able to fix the rules right now. They won't be able to shift the rules in a way that seems more fair right now. They're not going to. But I do think that there's a chance that considering the climate of the election right now and how disliked both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are, that there's the profit motive that could lead the networks to doing the right thing. And so we've already had on Fusion, they had the Libertarian, they had Gary Johnson. I believe CNN had a Jill Stein town hall.
Yep.
So we can't have the debate. You can't do that, whatever, with the DNC, the RNC. But there's no reason why the networks shouldn't want to attract a younger audience who doesn't watch CNN or Fusion normally, but might if Gary Johnson or Jill Stein are on the stage. So you might see that as a supplement to the election.
Johnny, I get my degree in advertising, and what you don't understand about advertising is that the advertisers covet the 71 to 80-year-old demographic. Yeah. They don't want the young kids because the young kids, they don't buy stuff and whatever. Old people are the ones that they really want. The 65,
and they watch the commercials because they literally can't get out of their chair.
Yes. It's the exact opposite. People, after they're 50 years old, they're set in their ways. And advertisers don't usually advertise the people over 50 because they already have their likes set, right? It's the people who are younger. So you're right. They should want to do this to get a younger audience. They won't because they're networks and they're fucking stupid.
They do seem to
be. No.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, just to clarify, though. The networks, I bet you if you gave them an option, they'd put Gary Johnson in there to mix things up and to make it more, I think they would think that it's more entertaining. I think they'd be right about that. No, they're desperate for access. Because if NBC says, hey, wait a minute, we should put Gary Johnson in debate, the presidential commission run by the Republicans and Democrats go, nah, I don't think NBC should moderate the debate. I think
so
ABC
I'm saying like
should.
Town hall or forum or something like
right.
that.
Right. So that's why in this particular case, the parties have all the power because they could go, I'm not going to give it to your network. I'm going to give it to the other network unless you shut the hell up and make sure that it's only the two of us in there.
Yeah.
So why don't I think Jill Stein and Gary Johnson should have a debate
You know, I've actually asked both of them to do that on the Young Turks.
Oh, you have?
But ironically, Gary Johnson says no.
Oh, really? Well, that's something. You know what?
I did not know that.
We
get asked that constantly. I did not know that they said no. When he said no.
When you asked him that, was he high?
Okay, a couple more numbers.
Can I just say real quick on this that I'm going to predict that Gary Johnson is going to make it into the debate.
Really?
Yeah, I think he is. I think that there's enough. The Democrats want him in the debate. And about probably a third of the Republican Party want him in the debate. It's going to be, and now 62% of the American people want him in the debate. There's going to be enough momentum for him to actually get in there, I think. And I think it's going to make a big difference. And I think he's going to, but the Republican Party will do that once they realize Trump is definitely going to lose, now, which is probably going to happen in a couple of weeks.
Do you think it's going to make a big difference because now we'll have another grown-up involved? In other words, if it's Hillary versus Trump, right, everyone's just literally watching to see, okay, what crazy thing will Trump say? What insults would he say? And if you add a third party to the debate, do you think that will put it more on topic and policy and so on? Or do you think now Trump is going to try to insult two people, you know?
He will definitely insult both people.
Yes.
Okay, that was an easy one.
No, he'll insult more than two. They don't have to be on the debate stage for him to insult people.
But isn't that the problem with this campaign and the networks when you talk about what they love Trump because every day he's going to say something crazy and that's going to get him some ratings. And what's interesting, what you said, Jimmy, the collision or the difference is, yes, young people are who the advertisers want, but old people are who the parties want because old people vote.
Right.
Yeah, you know, young people buy stuff, old people vote.
Right.
So if you ask the Republicans or the Democrats what demographic are we going for, they're like AARP. That's who we don't care if they don't buy the newest car or they don't buy the latest computer. They're going to show up on election day.
Yeah.
Young people are like, they might.
And
they might not.
And we're gonna sell those old people a catheter.
Yeah. And you can change that if you're young by voting and changing those numbers.
You know, and everybody... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to break down a couple more numbers really fast before we move on because we have other stuff we have to do. Really interesting Quinnipiac poll came out. We've talked in another video about the fact that 62% of the American public wants Gary Johnson included in the debates. Also, that was a poll. Quinnipiac is not some fly-by-night little polling outfit. It's one of the big presidential organizations. And it had Hillary Clinton up 51-41 over Donald Trump, which is just crazy. But they did have some more info about third-party candidates and what motivates people to support those candidates or not support those candidates, which I think is very interesting considering the climate that we're in. So if you could bring up graphic 7, it's going to break down just the odds that people would vote for a third-party candidate. So there, you're not weighting them down with thoughts about Stein or thoughts about Johnson.
Oh, okay.
Don't worry about all the numbers. Basically, on the left-hand side, 37% of the public says that they would consider it, 61% wouldn't, which overall is a little bit scary if you're a third-party candidate in terms of your potential. But you see there that independents are actually the majority would consider voting for a third-party candidate, men slightly more likely than women, which I think is interesting. And if you jump down to the bottom, the younger you are, the more likely you are to possibly support a third-party candidate, which the parties should take note of, because that's the future of the electorate right there, and 60% are considering third-party candidates. Now, if you jump to the next graph, you're going to see, so are you more likely to vote for a third-party candidate because you like one of the third-party candidates or because you dislike both major party candidates? And 65% are motivated by not liking the major party candidates. Again, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, not liked. That's especially true of the Republicans. 74, the vast majority are not thinking about supporting Gary Johnson because they love Gary Johnson, it's because they hate Trump. And then in this third graphic, you're gonna see something about the fears of voting for third party candidates. So would you say that you would not consider voting for a third party candidate more because you don't like any of the third party candidates, more because it would be a waste of your vote, which they don't define what that actually is supposed to mean, or more because you don't wanna risk either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump getting elected? And they're risking the major party win, which I think is the majority of what we talk about when we talk about people choosing not to vote for a third party candidate, even though they want to, is only 24% of that. The vague waste of a vote is actually the majority. And actually disliking the candidates is almost none of the reason why people wouldn't actually support them, which I think if you're a third party candidate, that is interesting information that you can use when you're crafting your advertisements and your strategy for how you're going to convince people. Now you know a little bit more about what's stopping some people from supporting you.
Yep. Okay, so we're almost out of time. So I'm going to ask that we do the Columbia story.
So, okay.
Okay, let's, guys, we're going to skip forward one story To the Colombian peace deal, because I think it's so important.
Yes. And we're not going to cover it, but it turns out that fracking can give you migraines and sinus headaches and things like that. So it's not just bad for the ground, it's bad for you too.
That's weird, but I thought methane was good for you.
Yeah. I had heard from some really high-placed person in the Hillary Clinton campaign that it didn't have any negative effects.
No, especially if it's
never
regulated.
Seen one, actually. Yeah. Okay. Colombia is now closer to a peace treaty with the FARC than it has been in half a century at this point. The government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia reached final agreements on the accord that's now going forward on Wednesday after an entrenched conflict that ravaged the country for more than 50 years, taking around 220,000 lives and leaving millions displaced. I've read somewhere about 5 million plus have been displaced as a result of this ongoing conflict. Something like 18% of the entire population of the country has been affected in some fashion by the conflict. Many people have grown up, lived their entire lives during this conflict. So the accord that's now going forward towards a referendum lays out the terms under which rebels will disarm and eventually enter civilian life again. We have a comment from Juan Manuel Santos, the president of Colombia, who says, "We are giving the final word to the people. Peace is always better than war. It will remove the fear we have all grown up with after so many years. Peace offers opportunities that most Colombians never had." So this will go forward sometime in the next, I believe, the next 30 days towards a popular referendum. But this is already a lot of progress. There have been something like four or five instances historically where they've come close to some sort of treaty. But people on both sides say that the promises that have been made, the psychological approach of those who are debating this and have been negotiating it for at least 4 years is far more serious than in the past. And a lot of people believe that this could actually pass. But that doesn't mean that everybody likes this agreement. Opponents of the deal, led by former President Alvaro Uribe, says it gives rebels amnesty for too many crimes and is unfair to law-abiding citizens because it calls for subsidizing fighters as they leave jungle and mountain hideouts to look for work. And we actually have some numbers on what that would actually look like. Part of the plan to help the FARC fighters involves paying them 90% of Colombia's minimum wage as they emerge from their strongholds. The negotiators compared the roughly $200 subsidy to the thousands of dollars spent on each army bombing raid. It's easy to look at that money and say that's a lot of money that would be going to people that I hate, but fighting the people you hate is also extremely expensive.
Okay, so this one has a clear answer. This is a wonderful treaty and a wonderful process by which they arrived there, except for the 52 years preceding it. So when it seems on the surface like Uribe, the former president, is making some interesting points. Wait, why are we subsidizing these guys? Did FARC commit atrocities? Definitely, they did. There was one horrible one that where they bombed a church. Over 100 people died inside the church. There was great atrocities on all sides. But when you look and giving amnesty, if you had a family member who died in that church or many other atrocities, you know that is a very, very hard thing to do. I get that. I'm not treating that lightly. But when you look at the overall context, what you find out is Uribe also did a peace deal with the other side. So FARC is leftist. Mm-hmm. Uribe, when he was president, made a peace deal with the far-right paramilitaries. And you find out that the paramilitaries actually did 70% of the massacres, mm-hmm. atrocities, and crimes during that 52-year stretch. So the far-right paramilitaries who already got their deal, who already got their amnesty, who already got all this stuff, did more of the crimes. And then Uribe was very happy about that. Oh, yeah, good, my guys, you're all free to go. The other guys, no, we don't. No, that's not how you do peace. You do peace by actually bringing the country together. And yes, at some point saying, although these horrible crimes have been committed, we have got to get past it. 52 years is enough. I mean, I love this because it sounds like a fair deal that both sides are finally agreed to. And no one's ever going to be completely happy. That's not how peace deals work. It's a negotiation. It's a compromise. Are relatively happy with. They're going to go to the people, and they're going to do a referendum so the Colombian people get to decide for themselves. Wonderful. Then they're going to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which then says, hey, listen, because these things happen, we shouldn't brush it under the rug. Because we did a peace deal and gave amnesty, by the way, to terrible atrocities on both sides, from the far right and far left, that doesn't mean that that was okay. We need to find out what happened and get past it as a country. And to me, another part of this that's so great is the legacy of Nelson Mandela. So he's in a lot of ways, he started this idea where he said, yes, but man, have there been terrible atrocities done to black folks in South Africa? In a lot of ways, it couldn't get worse. But we are going to get past it. And we're going to do it through peace, and we're going to do it through truth and reconciliation commissions. So for when I see any country that can get past a 50-year mistake and actually head towards peace, it is such great news. And if they can make it work in Colombia, maybe we can dare to dream that we could do it in other places like the occupied territories. And, you know, and you go down the list. I mean, look, we did it in Ireland. And you think Ireland was easy? It wasn't easy, right? In Northern Ireland, I mean, there was terrorist bombing after terrorist bombing and oppression from the British side. And deep, you know, seated anger and rage over, you know, all the deaths and murders and oppression. But we got past it. So this is fantastic news. I mean, we don't get to vote, right? So the people of Colombia will decide at the end if they want it or they don't want it. But I hope to God they give it a chance, because I think this is a great direction, not just for Colombia, but the whole world. Okay, and can I give one more shout out here to actor and activist Hector Aristizabal? Sorry, Hector, I don't know how to pronounce your last name. I'm sure likewise, right? But I did not know about him until I started reading about the peace deal. And what an unbelievable guy. I want to share three quotes of his from you, because he got, so give you context. Back when he grew up in Colombia, he's from Medellin, he was captured by the government when he was going to university. They thought he was part of FARC. He wasn't. They were wrong. And they tortured him.
Yeah.
And so, by the way, they beat him. They deprived him of food, sleep, water. Waterboarded him and electrocuted him, right? Not electrocuted, obviously, to the point of death, but gave him electric shocks. By the way, when I saw that list, I was like, oh my God, we did every one of those things to the people in Guantanamo except the electrocution, right? And that in Abu Ghraib, we pretended to do, but didn't actually carry out. So is waterboarding torture? Yeah, for decades earlier, the Colombian government was doing that to its detainees. It's textbook torture. Anyway. Yeah.
Well, enhanced interrogation.
That's right. Yeah. And so
but enhanced.
Sounds nice.
And the paramilitary groups killed his brother. Okay? And he said, look, and he's the one that brought up the church, etc. And he's like, FARC is guilty not only of all those atrocities, but that they took a movement that could have been great and misdirected it and then got involved in drugs and just absolutely ruined it. And so he's like, all these sides have done terrible things, including my family. But for God's sake, we've got to get past it for the next generation. And so he says the peace process cannot really be signed on a piece of paper in Havana, where they were negotiating, between the guerrillas and the government. It has to be signed in the hearts of the people. So that's a beautiful thing to say, but it's also incredibly true. Because unless they agree, that's why I love that there's a referendum, it's not going to stick anyway.
Yeah.
Right? They'll go back to war unless they found real justice, real equilibrium. And go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I mean, I fully agree with you. You know, the interesting thing about this, and you talked about the drug aspect, and you talked about the complaints with the money aspect, and they always bring that in. But yeah, it is cheaper to not be at war. And when you look at the nation of Colombia, what this has done, 52 years of fighting, I mean, I compare this to like the gang problems we have here, like when you had the Crips and the Bloods and they were going at it, their biggest problem was the history, right? Because if you were a Crip, a Blood killed your big brother. So now you have to kill one of theirs. And at some point, they both said, okay, we got to let that go. Like, it's unfortunate that this history, and it's the same thing here. It's unfortunate, the history, the atrocities. But like you said, like Nelson Mandela said, or this activist said, it'll never be even. There'll never be enough people killed on the other side to make you feel like, okay, now we're even. So at some point, you have to stop and say, it's a horrible historic tragedy, but we're going to stop now and move forward from here. For the sake of Colombia, this nation, so much of this country has been devoted to this war. Like you said, 18%, that's a huge amount of people, of money, of resources, and just hatred that has stopped the country from moving forward in so many other ways. So hopefully this does work.
Alonzo, Hector also said something else that is perfectly related to what you were saying. He said all reparations are symbolic. No one can bring back the 45,000 people who were disappeared, assumed dead, or dumped in mass graves, even the 5 to 7 million people who've been displaced from their lands. And we don't know how many of them can return to their land and recuperate what they had before. So what he's saying is, It's never going to be even, and we're not going to bring those people back. And some of them are my family members, and it kills me, and it breaks my heart, and I'm not going to get my brother back. But the reparations are symbolic so that we can move forward. So I wish people could understand that in other conflicts, because all we do is keep count. Well, they did that first, and then no, and both sides are absolutely convinced that the other side did everything first and that they must have revenge. If they don't have revenge, we'll never solve it, right? Revenge is the answer. It's never been the answer. The only answer is truth and reconciliation.
Good for a little while, though.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. I know. But it's true. Revenge does feel good. That's why we keep doing it as human beings.
Yeah, except that when you get revenge, they get revenge.
That's right. And
it's never even.
And finally, one
more
quote.
What if we crush them?
Oh, yes.
What if we get revenge and then crush them so they can't revenge us?
I'm just curious, why do you have Jimmy here?
finally, one more quote because it's too good. He said, the country is not afraid of peace, it's afraid of the truth.
Mm.
And he said, because if you know the truth, you know that the right-wing paramilitaries did do more massacres. They did 70% of the 2,000 massacres. If you know the truth, you know the government did a lot of torture, did a lot of sanctioning of the paramilitaries, disappeared a lot of people. And that's an uncomfortable truth to have to deal with and to say, yeah, we did that. So, and he's so right. I mean, even here in America, the truth is so uncomfortable for a huge percentage of our population, they don't want to hear it. They say, no. It's not a debatable issue. Yeah. America is awesome. And if you tell me things that are true about America that is not awesome, then it's your fault, not America's fault.
Yep.
But hearing the truth gets you to a better place, helps you to fix the problems that you have. So that's, you don't do that because you hate your country. You do that because you love your country and want to make it better. So, and he's right. A lot of people are afraid of that. But if you push past it, you get a peace deal like this, and things get better, not worse. So.
Yeah.
And some people will vote that way. Let's go, Colombia. Great job. Finish it. Okay, speaking of which, we're done with the first hour. Okay, Anna's coming up next in the second hour. The judge in the Stanford rape case, something interesting has happened to him. And I'll now begin to defend him a little bit, which is also interesting. And then the burkini ban. It's now gotten to a point where
I thought it was a Burger King ban.
It's a burkini ban.
It totally changes it.
Right. It's gotten like as if they're trying to copy Muslim fundamentalists. Okay, yeah. So we'll explain when we return.